At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
It's no secret that Food 52 loves genius recipes. If I were handed a story that began that way, as an editor, I'd cut it. It's a little lazy and declarative. It's also overused, so it can feel insincere. But here, it's not. It's one of the most appropriate ways to start a podcast about Kristen McGlory and the Genius Recipes column. She's been uncovering these recipes for 5 years in a James Beard-nominated column. She's turned them into a book and fed the tests to our team over and over again. We love them. Everybody knows it. What you might not know is what it takes to declare a recipe genius, or where Kristen finds them, how she tests them, or the ones that have a life of their own. I'm Kenzie Wilbur, this is Burnt Toast, and today, Genius Recipes' Kristen McGlory, and full disclosure, my friend and colleague for the past 4 years, tells us all of it. And just a quick note before we dive in. We mentioned a lot of recipes in this episode. We hope you'll take the techniques we describe and apply them at will to other recipes, but for the full list, head to the site. I'll post all the links there. Okay, so let's back up and talk about, for people who don't know and aren't avid followers of the column on Food 52, what is a genius recipe?
So the simplest definition is just that it's a recipe that will change the way you cook, and that's actually the subtitle of the book. Title being Genius Recipes, and then subtitle 100 Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. And the point of that is that the recipe itself is not necessarily totally flawless or foolproof or any of those words, but there's some technique in it that will make your cooking easier, better, more delicious. And they also come from geniuses directly. So they're all from food luminaries, cookbook authors, bloggers, chefs, people who have been working in food for a really long time, and we have decided to call them genius.
So they're all, it's a collection of recipes from other people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, well, I want to dig into the easy right now, because I feel like a lot of people, maybe my mother included, think that genius recipes means that it must be easier and faster than the other method of doing something. And that's not always the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is actually funny. When people will introduce me or the book, they'll say, oh, she writes about genius recipes. Are these quick and easy recipes that, like, you know, you can get your pancakes on the table in 20 minutes or less or whatever. And that's not exactly what it is. A lot of times it involves a shortcut, just because that's like that in itself, it can be surprising. And, you know, to realize that you don't have to always do this thing that everyone always told you you had to do.
So because I believe in journalism, I fact checked myself here. And I was wrong. Here's my mom's definition of a genius recipe, which doesn't include the word easy, but is another way to look at the category as a whole. A genius recipe is a recipe you'd make for guests knowing it will be wonderful.
In some cases, there are recipes that actually take quite a bit longer, or there'll be a different kind of, you'll just use your time differently. Like, you'll spend a little bit more time up front in order to spend less time later. So, for example, like vodka pasta, you might think it's just going to be like tomato, vodka, onion, garlic, cream in a pan, quickly throw it with some pasta. Like, it'll be a quick dinner. But the recipe that I ended up featuring was one through Ina Garten, and it roasts that sauce, that basic sauce, in the oven for 2 hours. So it's not quick and easy. It's not a weeknight dinner that you can have when you get home from work, but it's so much better that it's well worth it. So whatever the trick is to the recipe, it's worth it.
Yeah, and the roasting is the genius part, right?
Yes.
So then what other sauces can you roast?
Exactly. Like,
and you address that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically any marinara based tomato based sauce you can roast and it'll have much more intense flavors. But the vodka in particular, it like the more it has time to interact with the tomatoes, I think the better it tastes.
I'm trying to think of my favorite genius recipe of all time. And it might be Marcella sauce.
Really?
And in that sense,
it's not the chicken.
The chicken is good.
Barbara Kafka chicken.
I have a lot of favorites. Roasting your chickens at 500 degrees brings me a lot of joy. So I realize we're speaking full-on genius right now. For those of you who aren't fluent, we're talking about Marcella Hazan's genius 3-ingredient tomato sauce. It's tomatoes, onion, and butter simmered until reduced. We're also talking about Barbara Kafka's roast chicken, which you've roasted at a temperature much higher than you'd expect for only 10 minutes per pound.
Those two are really like kind of the ultimate examples that I give people, and they do both happen to be shortcuts.
Although like Marcella sauce isn't super fast.
It's not super fast, but it's fast compared to like a sundae sauce.
That's true.
And also it's a shortcut because it's so streamlined. You're not even chopping the onion. You're just taking the halved onion, simmering it with butter that you have not even like cut up or anything, and tomatoes in a pot for what, 30 minutes, 20 minutes? And you get like a super rich marinara sauce.
I love the amount of butter in that sauce. It's almost a little Beardsian.
Yeah.
So just throw it in there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how do you find these recipes?
I rely very heavily on the Food 52 community. They've, from the very get-go, been sending me tips. And I have a little thing at the bottom of every article saying to send me your tips if you've been cooking something for 20 years, or if you've seen it on Twitter recently or heard about it at a dinner party, I want to hear about it. And just having that like layer of community involvement means that I have to spend a lot less time searching. I can trust them that they think that it's worthwhile. And then I test it. And then basically, like, if it works out well for me, then it advances, I guess, in the genius gauntlet.
But that's actually a good point, that you're getting these recipes from, I'm sure you're finding a lot of them on your own. You're getting a lot of recommendations from the community. And that means that they're not necessarily undiscovered.
Mm-hmm.
So you've covered a good bit of recipes that have already been written about. So mm-hmm. why cover them again?
That's actually one of my favorite parts about the column, is that I could write about something that was popular last week or 3 months ago or 30 years ago, or maybe it was completely undiscovered. And it's kind of fun to bounce back and forth between those each week, because even on the ones where you might think that everyone's already heard about Jamie Oliver's chicken and milk or whatever, like that it's not news really, those are actually maybe some of the more fun ones to post about, because then everyone in the comments section has an opinion and an experience with it, or they've been cooking it for however long, or maybe it didn't work for them, and like that conversation gets going. So I actually like to cycle those in sometimes, which wasn't something that I realized at the beginning.
People always want to talk about it.
Yeah.
People always will want to talk about one ingredient, banana ice cream.
Yes.
And those are some of the ones that I love a lot too. Those quirky, like other world ones, like that was a raw food blogger trick.
Yes.
For a long time.
Yeah.
And the sweet potato slaw, like mm-hmm. raw food bloggers, and you sort of find them in these weird nooks and pluck them out and like feed them to a wider audience.
Yeah. Sometimes those communities that have these self-imposed or not limitations end up discovering something new that an ingredient can do, because they don't like have these assumptions already in place. So, everybody thinks that sweet potato is poisonous if you eat it raw. And that's only true if you eat a whole lot of it and like nothing else pretty much, and no other protein. But like in other parts of the world, people eat raw sweet potatoes all the time. And it takes something like a raw food community to realize actually how delicious it can be.
Let's back all the way up. What was the first genius recipe that you ever posted?
It was River Cafe's strawberry sorbet, which really, it's bizarre that lemon isn't in the title because there's three ingredients, and it's strawberries, sugar, and lemon. And the lemon is basically whole. You chop it up. You just get rid of the seeds. That's it. But the rest of it all goes into the food processor with the strawberries and the sugar, and they kind of make this, like, tart, creamy, slushy, bright pink substance that you can then churn, and it turns into this really good sorbet. And then you can, you know, depending on if your strawberries are super ripe or not, or how big your lemon is, you can adjust to taste. But it's really good, and it's also really, really, actually, I hate to use the word foolproof, but truly, like, I've taught it in classes, and every different student's batch comes out this, you know, not the same, but really good. And, you know, they've adjusted it to their taste.
It's so much better than it should be.
Mm-hmm. And the rind makes it's, again, one of these ingredients that people think, like, you should just banish from your cooking. But it both adds bitterness to kind of balance out the sweetness, but also makes it creamy in a kind of bizarre way.
So since that recipe 5 years ago, the mission obviously hasn't changed much of the column. But are you changing how you're testing things or writing about them or thinking about them?
I'd say the biggest change over the years is that in the beginning, I really thought we were going to run out of ideas or run out of steam. You know, we would do, like, all the iconic best versions of things, and we'd just be done. Like, we published the best roast chicken, and we published the best ratatouille, and then we would just kind of, like, well, that's all the things we eat.
That's it.
We're done.
Nowhere else to go.
And then a couple years ago, I actually, speaking of Jamie Oliver's chicken and milk, I actually published two chickens cooked in milk within, like, 3 weeks of each other. And they were,
they might have been in a row.
They were not literally in a row, but they were within the same month.
Yeah.
And that's how far we had come. Like, they actually, even though the kind of, you know, they were both chicken cooked in milk, which sounds gross and is so wonderful and does this really amazing thing to chicken.
But it sounds disgusting. It sounds like hot guacamole.
Yes.
Quick bit of context. We just come from filming one of our April Fool's videos starring none other than hot guac. It's a video of Kristen showing us how to make a recipe that might actually be a little genius too. Bacon guacamole chicken bombs from BuzzFeed Tasty. Hot guacamole. We were talking about on the way in here, like, what are the foods that just sound disgusting and, like, you never want to eat? Like, oven-cooked milk, chicken, just, like, it's sitting in a bath of milk, which then curdles.
Oh, yes.
It's actually so glorious.
Yes. Well, because the lactic acid in milk is tenderizing, and then also, and some fat is also kind of, like, protective. And so when you braise a lean protein in milk, it's just a great technique. And so, yes, I wrote about it first. Jamie Oliver's, and then Richard Olney's chicken gratin, which is, just, you know, it's got some other tricks to it. It's a little bit richer. It's got some cream and some cheese and some wine and, like, buttery, chickeny breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
And
it's heaven on earth.
It's so good. And so, of course, I had to write about both of them. They are very different experiences. And people went crazy for them, and they were, like, the top two posts of the year. So there is no one chicken and milk. You can talk about a different genius chicken and milk probably every week for a while and be okay.
And be totally fine.
Yeah.
But is there a tip off when you know that a genius recipe is just going to do very well?
I have a good feeling after doing it this long. Yes, I know that the chocolate cakes and the chocolate chip cookies and the chickens and things like crispy potatoes, all those are going to obviously resonate with people, but there are surprises all the time. Like, when I look back at the top 10 from last year, there were sauteed mushrooms cooked in pickle brine, which apparently people had a hankering for.
And they didn't even know.
They didn't even know they wanted the pickle mushrooms, but Stuart Brioza did.
That's the genius.
Yes.
Let's talk about the duds.
Ooh, the duds.
You know, I imagine for a lot of the genius recipes, you go into testing really wanting them to work. Are there ones that have just totally flopped?
Oh, so many. But it's I don't blame the recipe for that. I'm calling it genius. I have a pretty high bar for it has to be both really, really good and really worth it. It has to be worth the time, the dishes, the, like, you know, hunting down the ingredients. It needs to kind of have a balance of cost benefit to it. And even if they fail miserably, I still don't necessarily blame the recipe, because it could be so many things.
Yeah.
And maybe it was a recipe that was popular 40 years ago and things have changed. Like, ingredients have changed.
And also preference for how people like things yes. cooked. I was talking to Amanda Hesser, the founder of our company, about this. About how an old recipe was calling for you to boil a vegetable. I think it was broccoli for like 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you do that, it turns to absolute mush. Mm-hmm. Like, you just nothing. You can't, all the flavor is boiled out. It doesn't really, it's nothing there anymore. It could just be like people really like their vegetables cooked that way, mm-hmm. you know, in the turn of the century or whatever. So that's another factor with historic recipes.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing that happens a lot is that people will say this is genius, but they don't tell me the changes they made. So I am always testing it literally. And because I very rarely will make any changes to the recipe. So, you know, someone will tell me that this like cubed roasted sweet potatoes in a skillet is really genius. And then I go to make it and I literally buy the sweet potatoes that are 3 pounds and I take out the 8-inch skillet and then I try to put them all in the skillet and they do not fit. And then I go back to the person and let them know what happened. And they're like, oh, well, of course I like bumped it up to a big old baking sheet.
What about the other way around? Recipes that just read too crazy to work. I was just talking to Matt Sartwell, for another episode, and he was saying that in the Smitten Kitchen cookbook, Deb has a slaw recipe and half of the dressing is water. And he was like, this sounds disgusting. It's sort of like a mixture of when you encounter these recipes, you're like, either the copy editor wasn't doing their job or like this person is untrustworthy altogether. And then you make it and you're like, oh my God, mm-hmm. I'm going to put half water in all of my dressings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Rao's meatballs is one of those, right?
Yes. Or you just think you know, you know, you assume that you know best.
Of course.
And so it's really easy to dismiss a recipe because of that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the fun thing about my job is that I get paid to like ignore that feeling. The meatballs are, what, 2 cups of water mm-hmm. and I think 2 cups of breadcrumbs and then kind of comparable amounts of beef, pork, and veal. But you, like, you're just looking at this bowl of kind of like a normal amount of meatball and you have a pint of water that's about to go in it. Mm-hmm. And you're like, this is going to be so disgusting. It's going to be like raw meat soup. But then once you pour it in, it hydrates the breadcrumbs and they lighten the mix and the meatballs are super tender.
Yeah. And it takes a little while too, to like, you want like delicately work it in, but as you go, more of the water is absorbed by more of the bread and you're like, oh my God. It's like happening in front of your eyes. Mm,
becoming a meat pillow.
The meat soup is turning into a meat pillow.
Yeah. And that's something you want to eat is the meat pillow instead.
I don't know what I'm doing with my hands right now. I'm making the meatball motion.
You're doing
a
really soothing meat pillow fluffing motion.
The cauliflower soup that you have on the side is another one because it's just cauliflower and water.
Mm-hmm. And an onion.
And an onion.
Like a tiny bit of olive oil to get it started.
Right.
And you would think that would be just like the most bland, like thin gruel of a soup. But, and you know, people think that cauliflower soup needs cream or chicken broth or whatever. Actually, what I discovered way after the fact was that cauliflower naturally has pectin in it, which is the same thing that's in fruit when you make jam. It just kind of naturally occurs in some fruits and vegetables. And that, when you blend it, thickens it naturally. So it tastes very creamy, but doesn't actually have any cream in it. And yeah, that's another one that a Food 52 member sent to me. And I would never have been able to find it in a cookbook on my own. And it was another one where, like, it really hadn't been covered anywhere else. So having someone who was brave enough in the community to test it on their own and tell me that it had worked for them is, you know, it's now one of the most popular recipes on the site.
Mm-hmm. The idea of a genius recipe being perfect is not totally correct. It doesn't mean that it's not flawed in any way, right? We were mm-hmm. talking about that earlier, how it doesn't mean that it can't be improved upon. It just means that there's one little specific point in the recipe that makes you think and changes the way that you cook.
Mm-hmm. And actually, there have been cases, there's one really like notable case that always comes to mind where the recipe was genius, and now it's not so much anymore. The Anne Saran's rib roast of beef, That one, oh gosh, I forget when it was published, but it was decades ago, and it came out perfectly. Basically, the technique is you take a prime rib. Depending on how many ribs you have in the roast, it prescribes a different amount of time for it to be seared at 500 degrees in the oven, and it has kind of this coat of flour and salt and pepper on the outside, so it gets this really great crust. And then you shut off the oven. You know, it's something like you'll roast it for like 12 minutes, and then you shut off the oven and let it just finish kind of like coming down. And then so it gets this really great crust on the outside, and then it cooks slowly through to the middle. And both times I tested it, and then I put it up, and people were starting to make it and starting to say that theirs was totally overcooked. And I felt horrible because rib roasts are really, really expensive.
Yeah.
And it turned out that some ovens these days are just so efficient, energy efficient. You know, they're like super insulated. And so they held onto the heat much more intensely than they did 40 years ago or whenever this recipe was first published. And so it's not really quite as genius as once was.
Because of technology.
Because technology changed.
So does a genius recipe then have a lifespan, or is it just more case by case?
I think my warm and fuzzy heart would say no, they don't have a lifespan, but except for in extreme cases where the world kind of outpaces it. But even the rib roast is probably a really wonderful technique in new ovens, but it would just need to be...
If you can get the time right.
If you can get the time right and you can, like, you know, maybe it only takes 2 minutes and then it kind of hangs out for a while. But without being able to test in a bunch of different ovens, I wouldn't feel great about shoving it out into people's holiday tables again.
I'm sad thinking about them cutting into that roast.
Oh, my gosh. I know. It actually happened to my family, too. We did it that Christmas, and I was so excited to show it off. Oh. And then we cut into it, and it was, like, just medium well all the way through.
Oh. Yeah. I feel like you didn't have at least someone at the table who wanted it medium well.
Yeah, my grandmother was fine.
Yeah, I was just going to say my grandfather would have been all over that.
Yeah.
So what are you still on the hunt for?
Earlier this year, I put up a post that was like the 16 recipes I'm still searching for, and they were all my holy grails. And maybe they're holy grails because I just have this ideal in my head that it needs to achieve. Maybe they're holy grails just because they're kind of a lot of work and I don't always feel like I have time to test them. Like the two that are standing out in my mind are cinnamon rolls and lasagna.
Lasagna.
Yeah, lasagna. Like, how great would a genius lasagna be?
Yeah. But maybe you could find one that's genius because it doesn't kill you on time.
If you're listening,
please
a dusty cookbook with a really brilliant lasagna recipe, please send it to Kristen@food52.com.
Please send lasagna. In case you didn't catch that, it's Kristen.McGlory@food52.com. Send your genius tips and tell her why the recipe has changed the way you cook. The Food 52 editorial team is always on the hunt. You should join us. Like I said, we're disciples. To further prove that I wasn't just using hyperbole for the sake of rousing conversation, here are some more of us just to back me up.
My favorite genius recipe, and really the recipe that made it clear to me what was so incredible about this column, is Diana Kennedy's carnitas, which is truly ridiculous because it basically takes pork and water and a little bit of salt and turns it into the very best taco filling you could ever dream of.
Last year on Valentine's Day, a group of friends and I had a Valentine's Day potluck, and I brought the Maialino olive oil cake, which I had never made before. And it disappeared, but I think that is really emulative of what genius recipes are. They're recipes that you feel like you can trust completely and throw yourself into. And serve to other people, even if you've only cooked them once.
The thing that makes genius recipes genius is not, in my opinion, the actual recipes, as the name would suggest. The recipes are stellar, no doubt, but the genius parts are the little nuggets of knowledge within them that Kristen finds to share.
I really love almost every vegetarian genius recipe I've ever tried. I also love Alice Medrich's cocoa brownies. It's the only brownie recipe I make now. Marcella's sauce is the only tomato sauce I make. Jim Leahy's pizza dough is the only pizza dough I make. I made Yotam Ottolenghi's black pepper tofu, and I don't want to ever cook tofu in another way other than tossing it with cornstarch and frying it until golden brown and crispy and wonderfully chewy on the inside. I think Genius Recipes has really spoiled me because I expect every recipe I make to blow me away like the Genius Recipes do, and I'm disappointed when recipes are good and not great.
I think that Genius Recipes might be 90% of what I cook.
Once you make one, you're totally hooked. Like, you only want to cook Genius Recipes from then on. Trust me, make any of them, the guacamole, the sorbet, you'll totally get it.
And that's it for this episode of Burnt Toast. Like I said, I'll be gathering all of the recipes we mentioned today into a post. You can find them on Food 52. Thanks to my producer, Kristen Meinzer, and also to Laura Mayer, Henry Malofsky, and Andy Bowers at Panoply. Please let us know what you think of the show. Our Twitter handle is @food52, or you can leave us a review on iTunes, like Carlita029 did, who said our discussions were lovely. It was very nice of you, Carlita029. For Kristen McGlory and all of her devoted fans, I'm Kenzie Wilbur. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.